ICE is escalating deportation operations around the Los Angeles area. But if you are stopped by ICE officers, you have constitutional rights, regardless of your immigration status. If you or someone you know has been detained or wants to report ICE, more information is available at CIRLA at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at CHIRLA.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. Today, we're talking to transnational feminists from the amazing organization Affirm. Our guests today are Valeria Espinosa, who's the national chairperson, and chapter member Catherine Guerrero. And we are going to be talking about food stamps and how millions have had their benefits cut off. They may soon lose benefits permanently, and how this is a very gendered piece of oppression that's coming from the current regime. And that doesn't seem to be up in the conversation very much, but Affirm has stepped up with a statement about that, and they've laid out some very solid points about that. But I want to have a conversation with you both about facts, the figures, but also your personal experiences and how we can organize around this and beyond this. So welcome both to Feminist Magazine.
Thank you so much for having us.
Valeria, let's just start with you. If you could just briefly give our listeners a couple of sentences about Affirm and how you got involved and why.
Yeah, absolutely. So Affirm is an anti-imperialist, transnational feminist, woman of color-led organization. We are grassroots at our core. So we are, you know, all volunteer. We have several chapters across the U.S., including in the currently occupied Kingdom of Hawaii. The reason why I joined Affirm is because I found it to be my political home. My organizing background started in the time that I was at university when I was doing, Chicano organizing. But I've always felt that there was, you know, a lack of centering the women's experience and also of putting women's oppression as, seeing women's oppression as primary. So coming to Affirm, I actually joined in 2016 during the first time that Trump was elected. And I just thought, you know, I couldn't just sit on the sidelines anymore. I had to get out there. I needed to do something. And Affirm has become my political home over these years. So now being the chairperson in, 2025, the second time that, he got elected, it feels like a full circle for me.
And Catherine, how about you?
Actually, it's a very similar story. I have been an educator for over 20 years in the San Gabriel Valley, doing a lot of social justice work with my students. So very much just working with various organizations in Los Angeles County. And I myself was part of the American Indian Movement, Los Angeles chapter for a few years and organizing with them. And yeah, very similar as my sis here, Valeria said that, it was just not really thinking about the role that women, play in our homes and community and businesses and all of those spaces. And, why aren't we kind of at that center and in that forefront, looking at women as a political class and not, especially women of color, not even making it to the spaces where white women are at, So I was definitely allied with Affirm for many years with the work that I did with the American Indian Movement. And, you know, just kind of felt that it absolutely was more of a political home for myself, and that it was a space where I can definitely grow, continue to learn, continue to, you know, advocate, and but then also like have this sisterhood to lean on as well, which is really important, especially in times like this.
Yeah. And Valeria and I were talking a little before we started the interview about my admiration for Affirm in terms of the way it's organized, because there is this studying, discussion, learning part, and then also the praxis, like how you put it into action, and then the sisterhood, the community building that happens, which I think is a really, really wonderful model. So we should be sharing that model around a little bit, I think, especially nowadays. So let's start talking about your statement, which I thought was so well put together, about how the government-backed decision to cut SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, is a gender-based attack in policy form. And Valeria, who is disproportionately affected by these cuts?
So, you know, it is important to note that this is a very deliberate political choice to deny women, particularly Black, Indigenous, women of color, migrant women, immigrant women, you know, to deny food, dignity, and safety to people who are already carrying, you know, the heaviest burdens in our society. So we would go as far as to say that this is the feminization of survival. You know, women are making up for what the state is refusing to provide for us. And so, you know, these women, we are supporting families on already poverty wages, you know, that has been created by, you know, racial capitalism. You know, women are overwhelmingly responsible for the unpaid labor of feeding households, for caring for children and whatnot. So all of this is definitely a deliberate attack on women, especially Black, Indigenous women of color.
Right. There's definitely a systemic disdain and hatred for POC in so many ways, but this is very specifically women and children. So, Catherine, you yourself have been personally impacted by these cuts, right? Could you tell us a little bit about your personal experience?
So, like I mentioned before, I have been an educator for 20 plus years. I'm also an educator in the private school sector. So, not making the big bucks as my public school colleagues, but I mean, even then, what are we paying our teachers these days?
Right.
And again, to think about that, like you think about teaching is a traditionally feminine, you know, career, which is why our pay is lower than I have the same educational background as an engineer or, you know, any folks with advanced degrees, but, you know, because it was a traditionally woman's job, our pay is definitely significantly lower. But yeah, my husband is in end-stage renal failure, has been for about almost 2 years now. And so therefore, I am the sole income of the home, but he does receive benefits. And, you know, that is his contribution to the household, in which, you know, again, that system in itself to get to that point for himself to receive those benefits, it practically took him being at an end stage of life situation. And yeah, like, you know, he carries that with immense pride that this is at least what he can contribute to the home. And, you know, not only are we affected by the SNAP cuts, or that we're, you know, getting those text messages in late October saying that, you know, we may not receive our benefits, but, you know, that big, not so beautiful bill also has a on our toes when it comes to his treatment.
Right.
And thinking about, like, you know, we've had to look at what it would cost if we ever had to pay out of pocket for literally procedures that he receives three to four times a week that keep him alive. So, you know, when you're having to make these decisions about, okay, well, let's not spend everything that you have on your card. Let's see how much we can hold on to in case those payments don't come. then where does my income now get kind of, what can we stretch as far as our bills or other household expenses? It's just, it's a huge domino effect,
right?
In that sense. And not only, again, am I a full-time educator, but then also his full-time caretaker as well, you know? And so, again, just thinking about the programs that he's enrolled in that provide his transportation or provide the support for his medications in that sense. And if those all of a sudden disappear or quote unquote premiums double, it doesn't look too good.
Yeah. It's really the cruelty seems to be the point in terms of the slicing and dicing of people's very lives at risk. And in so many ways, as well, as you put into your report, 70% of the wage-earning adults who rely on SNAP and Medicaid actually work full-time. They're all working in these extremely low-paid but necessary jobs that are holding the whole society up. Let's talk a little bit about that and how people just don't seem to get that. Valeria?
Yeah, women are more likely to work in low-wage, unstable jobs that don't provide, a steady income or benefits. I believe here in LA County, women make up, I think, the majority, so 56% of the workforce. And as, you know, somebody who works at a labor union, a lot of our members, you know, who are employed still call us and are still seeking, you know, additional assistance and whatnot. So I think these cuts to the food assistance, it is, you know, intensifying, reinforcing these hierarchies, right, that are meant to keep women on the margins.
And Catherine, I'm so sorry to hear about your husband and the role of caregiver. I went through that myself for a few years. Is huge. It's a huge drain and an unspoken about part of women's unpaid and unrecognized labor. And does it feel like the state of California might be stepping in? Is that possible for some of these supports?
Yeah, so fortunately, and because of unions like SEIU.
Thank you, unions.
It's really interesting because you think about like IHSS, which is like in-home like care and services that are provided for folks like my husband. But when he went through the interview process for that, it's very interesting what they identify as quote unquote, well, they don't call it a wifely duty, but they call it a spousal duty.
Wow.
And so therefore, if you have a live-in spouse, then some of those duties are automatically assumed that that spouse is required to do that without pay. You know? Wow. So even, again, someone who is working a full-time job, like for example, it's 5:30. I just got home from work. And then to have to come home and then carry, you know, in the sense of like the home to make sure like, you know, things are done, put away, that type of stuff. You know, there was times where he had procedures and needed in-home assistance that I couldn't provide because I would have to work, and so paying for that type of healthcare or home health, you know, things. So yeah, like it really affects your livelihood in the sense of, you know, again, I want my husband to be home, to live in dignity. I want us to feel as quote unquote typical as far as enjoying, you know, life and in our home. But when you kind of carry the weight of being that full-time provider, also the caregiver, and then I hate to say that, like, my health now gets put on the back burner. And, you know, it's not by choice. Of course, my husband's always saying, make those appointments or do what you got to do. But, you know, being a caregiver is a whole other full-time job, making sure that appointments are lined up or you got that referral or you're calling the insurance company to make sure that, you know, this is getting paid. That's a whole other full-time job that even for myself, making a doctor's appointment or, you know, a regular annual checkup or any of those things often get neglected. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, I have a great support system. As I've mentioned, I have a great, wonderful sisterhood. I am fortunate to have family, but I couldn't imagine what it's like for other women that maybe do not have the access or do not have mm-hmm. the support that I have, you know, to carry this type of weight.
But astonishing that they actually count spousal support in as something, oh, well, then we don't have to cover as much. That is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Wow. So to turn also to other support programs, besides, we're not even going to talk about health insurance, which is just too terrifying for all of us to contemplate at this point. There's also WIC, which is the Women, Infant, and Children Supplemental Program, and that is access to infant formula, groceries for families. This is 41% of all infants in the US, and it is also at threat of being cut. And no one's talking about this. This is just astonishing to me. Do you feel the same way, Valeria?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that we should be putting at the forefront. You know, when we talk about taking away WIC, I mean, we're literally saying that kids are going to go hungry.
Right.
And if kids go hungry, what does that lead to? Worsening health, declining school performance and whatnot. So these are our babies. And, you know, we definitely, I don't know, I agree with you. I just can't believe that we're not putting this at the forefront.
Yeah. It feels very, I think, in a way, like the big stories, that big national stories seem to be all about power and as usual, and what is happening above us, quote unquote. But how can we get more of these stories out? Of course, today's conversation is one of those examples, but other ways that we can be doing this. And besides, I think a lot of folks are on social media and they're talking about supporting your local food bank or mutual aid setups or neighborhood groups, which are all wonderful. And I know that you guys have a really good list of resources. We'll also share on our social media with links for food banks or discounted meals and the way that the school district is supporting, et cetera, et cetera. But what other ways is a firm having conversations, Catherine, about other ways to take action?
I think one of like our mantras that, you know, we've had prior to this crisis, I mean, I hate to say that it's in crisis after crisis, especially for women, but, you know, is that like the personal is political. Mm-hmm. And I think just like you said, like through these types of conversations and actually just, you know, reaching out to coalition building to other communities, like asking for those needs. You know, what is it that our community needs? I apologize. And, you know, just again, continuing the conversation about like, what is it that is looking at that bigger picture, mm-hmm. really trying to understand how is this something that is specifically affecting women and children, right? What is like, you know, this is a system. This is something that's been happening for a very long time. You know, look at like the Black Panthers, right? They started with food assistance and right. with, you know, and so taking time to learn from the folks that have come before us as well. And to dialogue about that, you know, we have been generations of resilience and that we have the tools to navigate these moments, right? But we also have the power to take these on, right? You know, to find those targets, to find those folks that are going to be those movers and shakers and hold them accountable as well. We have local elections that are happening here in Los Angeles County. You know, who are our new targets? Who are we going to kind of hold to the fire mm-hmm. and say, are you going to bring this up or, you know, recognize these groups? And so really trying to have those conversations, you know, that's a lot of the work that we do. You know, we will literally set up a table, you know, in Highland Park. Prior to this crisis, we were looking at housing mm-hmm. and how housing in Los Angeles County was directly impacting women and children.
Right.
And we were literally just setting up tables and asking, like, what are your needs? What are you looking for? Mm-hmm. Again, I myself living in an apartment, and when my husband had to go into a wheelchair, like, accessibility in housing is, whoa, like, it doesn't exist. We had to pay for everything that was installed in a home that we don't even own so that he can navigate around our space. You know, and so that really, like, again, that brings up those questions. Well, what are those ADA laws, right? Or what are, like, you know, safety precautions that property units can take to ensure that women and children are safe? It's having these conversations with our community, coalition building, but then again, finding those targets. Who are going to be the people to make those moves here in Los Angeles? Mm-hmm. You know, and how do we continue to hold them accountable once they're in place?
And also, Valeria, holding their feet to the fire around budget priorities seems to be
absolutely
huge.
Yes.
This is really a big one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fighting these cuts means that we need to really fight for a world where these resources are directed towards care and not for, you know, war, corporate greed, bailouts for corporations. So, you know, it's important that in addition to everything what Catherine said, is also joining an organization. You know, I mentioned, you know, finding your political home and what is it that moves you, you know, to, you know, start organizing. And so I think this is an opportunity, you know, for women of color, right, to come together and say, you know what, I'm not going to stand by and let this happen. And I'm going to join an organization and fight back because I have no other choice. This is about survival.
Yeah, it's about survival, and it's about our neighbors and people that we care about. And I think we live in a big city, and there's always a lot of disconnection and people not knowing their neighbors. But there seems to be a shift around that, or perhaps I'm being a little bit extra hopeful here, but more connection, more people realizing that knowing your neighbors and building local connection is very important on that survival level.
Yeah, definitely. I would add to that too. I think, you know, in June when the ICE raid started here, that also, you know, it highlighted the importance of, like, who's our neighbor, you know, who's our community. You know, we need to really look out for each other.
Right.
You know, it's really sad to say, but some folks don't even look at each other eye to eye when passing each other, you know, and just saying hi and making those connections, because, you know, community is our best asset and our best way to fight back right now.
Well, I think looking at all of the food bank options, many of them are in California, many of them are local. You do have some others where you have other chapters of Affirm, and mutual aid seems to be, I know it's a newer word, although it's not a new concept, but I think folks also are looking for ways to how to start that, how to make that happen. What are your suggestions around that?
Yeah, I would definitely suggest, and again, like, I'm thinking from the work that I've done, like, within my schools, like, for the past 20 years, is that it starts with a conversation, and it starts with the ask of the community in which, like, you're, you know, hoping to be a part of or hoping to help, right? And so you need to first ask, like, what are the needs? Don't come in with the savior concept, like, I'm going to bring you all of this, but rather, what do you need? What's going to, you know, make things a little bit easier for you right now? You know, because you'd be surprised, you know, there's that misconception of, like, well, when you give folks SNAP benefits, like, you know, you still want to govern what they're spending it on. And it's, and again, that's also a very kind of gendered thing, right? It's more often than not, like, well, her nails are done, or she has a nice purse or wallet that card's coming out of. And again, who cares? Why are you focusing on women?
Right.
Right. And the ways that they want to maybe take care of themselves. You know, why can't I have nice nails? You know, I get my nails done every month. But it's like we don't need to govern. We just need to simply ask. And that's where you will find, like, what are the needs, right? You know, there may be a community that says, yeah, you know what? Actually, we're really great on food, but what we really need are, like, gas cards right now. Because we had to make that adjustment, right? We had to make that adjustment you know, we spent our traditional gas budget, but now it was spent on food. So now we need gas cards. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where the conversation starts, is in that ask. And then also just building the community. Again, you're not there to deliver, to drop off. It's not transactional. Mm. You know, it's about being in community. And like you said, mutual aid's that new word, but it's not new. Mm-hmm. You know, all of us had grandmas with the big bags of beans and rice growing up, and that if anybody knocked on our door, we'd offer. So it's not something new. And it's something that is very intuitive to us, I think. Valeria is talking about, like, you know, we don't even look at each other. And there's a quote that I've kind of held very close to me pretty much since the raids, because, like, it was brought up that it's brought these moments of connection. And it's a quote by Mother Teresa, actually. And it's sometimes we forget that we belong to one another. Mm-hmm. And it's intentional, just as you said, you know, it's intentional. It's the way our streets are designed. Mm-hmm. It's the way our cities are put up. We live in boxes. It is intentional to isolate. That's capitalism, right? It's individualistic.
Right.
And so when you forget that we belong to each other and we don't live in community and connection, then that's success on capitalism's part, because then you're not going to pay attention. And so, yeah, you know, in some ways, as tragic, absolutely tragic as these raids have been, it's opened our eyes and it's opened communities' eyes. And yeah, we start by, it's kind of funny to say that we start when you're actually returning to a very traditional system, right? And that is just the community listening and responding and just continuing to show up, you know? So if you get to donate, like, you know, 20 cans 1 week, but the next week you feel like you don't have anything to donate, well, still show up. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Still show up and check in.
Yeah. That's why the term is mutual aid, because mm-hmm. it's a two-way street. Well, Valeria, can you tell us where folks can read this statement and find out more about Affirm and stay in touch to see about more information, more actions, because this is a continuing conversation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're going to be revisiting this conversation again in a few months, right? Because this government shutdown, you know, they agreed that it was only a temporary thing. So, you know, we will be circling back to this. So, to find out more information about Affirm and to read our statement, you can visit www.af3irm.org. You can also find us on social media channels, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, same AF3IRM. And if you're interested in joining, go ahead and send us, you know, a message on any of our social media platforms. You can send us an email, AF3IRM at AF3IRM.org. And we'll definitely get you connected.
Amazing. Join the sisterhood. This is what I... we all need more sisterhood. Well, thank you so much, Valeria Espinosa and Catherine Guerrero from Affirm. We appreciate you so much. We appreciate the work that you're doing. And we will keep having these conversations and connecting, pushing, remembering how to do things. Thank you both for joining us on Feminist Magazine.
Thank you so much for having us. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
What's going on, Los Angeles? My name is Kat Brooks. I'm a boots-on-the-ground organizer, artist, abolitionist, and the host of Law & Disorder. Born at KPFA in the Bay 3 years ago, L&D seeks to be a partner in movement by making space and place for the freedom fighters locked out of mainstream media, artists using their work as active resistance, and connecting with our brothers and sisters on the other side of the walls. You can tune in for that fire Monday through Thursdays at 8 a.m. on 90.7 FM or online at kpfk.org.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting Third Coast Percussion and Solar Nader on December 6th at 8 p.m. at the Nimoy. Third Coast Percussion pays tribute to the late Zakir Hussain with Murmurs in Time, his final commissioned work. The program also includes solo tabla and new works by Jesse Montgomery, Tigran Hamasyan, and Jay Lynn, honoring Hussain's enduring legacy at CAP UCLA. More information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Patti Smith, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent Pacifica Radio, KPFK, 90.7 FM. People have the power.
The people have the power to redeem the work of fools from the meek, the grace to shower. It's decreed the people rule. People have the power. People have the power.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next, as organizers and activists, we've all been in those meetings, you know, the ones where we need to make decisions as a group or to vision a larger goal. And those kinds of meetings can be a struggle. They can be filled with lots of egos and unspoken agendas. Our guest today is Adrienne Marie Brown. She's an author, a visionary thinker, and so much more. And she has a book called Holding Change that offers a profound way to transform that process in meetings and in larger movement building in a time that we really so deeply need to shift the ways we work together and envision our future. So welcome to Feminist Magazine, Adrienne.
Thank you, Lynn. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So many exciting and expansive ideas to talk about here, but tell our listeners a little bit about what can holding change look like?
You know, for years before I was formally a facilitator, I didn't know that there was a language for facilitation, for what it was. It was just something that kept happening. You know, I'd be in a meeting like, we need some synthesis, or we need an agenda, or we need, we feel stuck. Like, how can we get through this moment? And my friend, Mia Herndon, who is now part of the Emergent Strategy Collective with me, she was the first person to hire me to facilitate. And over the years, I would find myself using different terminology to try to explain what it was I was doing. And one of the emergent terminologies was holding space. People would say, we're holding space. And that was made a lot of sense to me. It's just like we're really creating and holding a space in which humans can move through the difficult with each other with as much ease as possible. And once Emergent Strategy came out, what became interesting to me was that it wasn't just that we were holding a space in which anything could happen or in which stagnation was cool. We were really trying to hold a space in which change could happen, meaning that the individuals in the space felt like they could change and that was okay, that there was room for them to change, and that the relationships between the people in the space could change, and then that the group altogether could take seriously the fact that they were trying to change the world. And that's what, you know, people who are doing social justice, people who are doing movement work, it's basically people who are like shamelessly saying, there's some things with this world that could change, and we believe in our capacity to shape that. It's also an homage to Octavia E. Butler, who in some way, I think all of my work, I always try to touch back to the stone of wisdom that she offered us with so many of her texts, but particularly in the parables, she talks about change and shaping change, being a shaper as opposed to a victim of change. And I feel like that's the call, especially right now when circumstances are so overwhelming, both externally and within movement. It's such an overwhelming thing to try to be like with each other and hold each other. But Octavia said, all that you touch, you change, and all that you change changes you. And for facilitators and mediators, what we're doing is holding that, holding the changes that happen inevitably when we are in contact with each other, which we have to be on this tiny planet. So that's all the stuff that's happening in that title and in the book.
So much happening in the title. And a sentence that really resonated for me is the impossibility of consensus calls us to find ways of working together in difference.
You know, when I first started working in movement, I
naively believed that, oh, if we just all had the same information to work from, we would all reach the same conclusions, and then we would flow forward together in a heavenly, you know, Garden of Eden-like existence. And, you know, and so I became obsessed with data initially, you know, like, let's get all the information. Let's make sure we have all the information. And then, of course, you know what happens with humans, which is we have all the same information. We reach different conclusions because we come from different walks, different socializations, different perspectives, different needs. Many of our needs are unmet, you know, and unnamed. And so we're coming into any space. The difference is actually the point. And I didn't really understand that until I started really studying the natural world more and studying the patterns of emergence and really starting to understand that in a healthy ecosystem, the biodiversity is the health, right? The number of different ways of being that can coexist is a sign of the health. And so then I started thinking, well, what if we facilitated that way? What if we facilitated where the invitation was to have as many different ways of being in the room as possible, but to find ways to align ourselves in emotion towards futures that could sustain all those differences rather than futures that could only sustain one way of being. And that has become and continues to be of deep interest to me because I keep changing also. Like I keep changing as an individual. So it's not even, it's just like each person is the same unto themselves throughout their lives. Right? It's like we are coming into being and we're changing constantly. We're changing each other. We don't want to achieve a consensus that requires everyone being the same way and thinking the same things. And Loretta Ross has a beautiful quote about this, which is a group of people moving the same direction and thinking the same thing is a cult. A group of people thinking different things but moving in the same direction is a movement. And that, you know, I feel like it's such a teaching. That's like, how do we be a biodiverse movement that allows for the many different ways of being, right, to exist? I think disability justice is a great teacher of this also, right? It's like, how do we resist the idea that there's some norm that we're all supposed to achieve and some singular way of thinking that is correct? And instead, how do we embrace the fact that we're complex and we're changing?
Right. And I mean, you've partly started to answer this, but the title of the book is actually Holding Change, the Way of Emergent Strategy, Facilitation and Mediation. Yes. So it's part of a series based on your thinking around this idea of Emergent Strategy, which was your 2017 book. And it's about how we can partner with change,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's a very multi-layered concept, but can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that? It's so fundamental.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, looking at the natural world, there's certain elements and there's certain principles that, if you pay attention, seem to be present throughout all of the functional systems. So adaptation, intentional adaptation, being able to adapt in ways that move us towards life. Life continuously moves towards life. Fractals, like there's some patterns that move from the smallest scale to the largest scale. Interdependence, right? That in nature, everything is in relationships with each other. Nothing is trying to be an individual pulling itself up by its bootstraps in spite of everyone else, you know? And the species that are surviving have these patterns. And Emergent Strategy was starting to ask the question, what would it look like if humans humbled ourselves to find our patterns and to be in pattern with everything else? And the question, I don't know if you've ever sat and watched a murmuration of birds move through the sky, but they're avoiding predation and there's some guidelines to how they do it. And I started thinking, like, what would it look like if our movement was like a flock of birds? What would it look like if our movement was a murmuration? If we could trust each other, if we had the right space from each other, if we understood ourselves to be a body in motion rather than a bunch of bodies at odds with each other. So Emergent Strategy was that first offering. And then I've been gathering different texts and ideas and thoughts that went with it. But something people kept asking me about was like, well, how do you do facilitation? Because I get a lot of positive feedback about my facilitation. People are like, oh, you're so great at this. And I'm like, some of it is not nature, which I put that in Holding Change. There is a nature. There's some people who I think have a nature that orients around and makes it easy to do facilitation. Like it's in us. We pay attention in a certain way. But some of it can be learned. And I think everyone should have at least a basic concept of it, a basic capacity for it. because we need it in our families, we need it in our communities, right. We need it in our workplace. Even if we're not explicitly doing organizing, we need to be able to be in right relationship with each other. So holding change is my offer towards that. And there's a little bow to the Taoist text, which is the Tao Te Ching, because, you know, they talk about the way that can be named is not the way. Like, immediately, as soon as you try to say it, you know, like trying to put in a book, like, here's how I do what I do, I knew that there were some things that would never be translatable or couldn't go on the page. I'm still doing my best to offer the way of emergent strategy facilitation and mediation. And to that end, I have a lot of contributors in the book, a whole series of other Black feminists who are alive and working right now who have different ways than I do. And I thought that that was a way of nodding to that, right? That it's like, it's not actually one way. The way is a complex offering of ways of adapting together, breathing together, listening to each other, leaning into each other, grieving together, growing together.
Right. And let's talk about that. You've got this deeply significant section of writings under the heading Black Feminist Wisdom.
Yes.
And it includes some of my personal favorite movement writers,
mine
thinkers,
too.
Organizers. Yeah. I mean, particularly like Alexis Pauline Gums and yes. Melchior Cyril. And you talk about being part of a lineage, right, as a facilitator. What does that lineage mean? And how do these particular writers that you invited in, how do they hold that lineage with you?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I think there's a moment when you recognize nothing we're doing is being done for the first time. You know, Octavia right. talks about like, there's nothing new under the sun, but there are new suns. And I love that idea of like, how do we in our work honor the fact that like, there's nothing new. We learned this from ancestors, you know, and when we look back at the people that we honor as organizers, really a lot of what they were doing was also facilitation, right? They were gathering, they were synthesizing, mm-hmm. they were helping people figure out what moves could happen. That's a core piece of what it means to be moving other humans along in any shape. So some of them that are quoted in the book are Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Harriet Tubman. These are people who I think of as a lineage of Black women, Black feminists who pointed the way, helped gather, helped listen, helped to decenter, right? They were like, it's not about me. You have to make right. a choice to opt into history. You have to make a choice to opt into your potential and your greatness. So for me, the lineage is there. And then I think if you look at most of those people in the book, all of them are people who I've seen name explicitly. Oh, I'm in the lineage of Audre Lorde. Adaku Yuta, who offers us the care bearer, the care bearer approach of these care teams that allow a room to care for itself and create a community culture of care. She says that she partnered with Harriet Tubman in her work to create Harriet's Apothecary and create a healing arm inside of movement, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of the people in the book, Alexis is one of the first people who really gave me direct access to a lot of the lineage by saying, we need to take these words of Audre Lorde, I am who I am doing what I came to do, and we need to chant them and we need to let them be embodied in us. Harriet Tubman said, my people are free, not will be free, but are free. You know, mm-hmm. how do I embody that? So I think these people, one of the things that I wanted to do was shine a light on them while they're alive, right?
Oh, yeah.
And say like, you are a part of Black movements and you're part of multiracial movements and you're part of movements for change in large part because of these people. These people are behind the scenes, holding space, holding change, holding connections, mediating conversations, helping people create safer spaces, helping people think about security, helping people think about boundaries. Like these are these Black women who are behind the scenes doing this work. And often they don't get seen until they've passed and, you know, people are like, okay, now let's give them their flowers. But I'm like, they're alive. You can access their wisdom right now. You know,
yeah.
They're going to continue to learn and change and write, and you should be paying attention to them. So that's what felt important to me. And to have also expressions where it was like, it wasn't just Black feminists who were femme presenting or femme identifying, but it was a
right.
wide spectrum of Black feminists who I included in the text, because that also feels important to understand in the current moment. But I think that they are the lineage for any future generations of movement. right? We are the lineage, and I wanted to name ourselves and weave ourselves in explicitly. Like, here's what we are thinking about. Here's something that we have to offer. Here's some things that we know.
We're talking to Adrienne Marie Brown about her book, Holding Change. So lineage in the sense of it's not a past thing that you sort of look at and polish and put on a shelf, but it's current and living and woven in. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that Indigenous worldview holds is that seven generations back, seven generations ahead,
right,
that you're actually always in the river that has directions of flow in both ways. And something about that to me is like, well, then how do I be a responsible future ancestor, as well as how do I responsibly receive what has been offered to me?
They're talking about things like breathing and boundaries and, you know, space, safe space or not safe space. There's actually both. And also the ways of facilitation that you offer are all deeply part of feminist thought. And yet so much we hear sort of the 101, like the equal rights and the, but I love that you bring in all of this kind of deeper and more horizontal, collaborative, those aspects of feminism that sometimes we forget, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we can get so caught up in contending for what's the definition, what's the way that it's done, and we really can focus on the mistakes that have been made. Every movement is constantly making mistakes. And I think there's, you know, my thing is, I don't think there's failure. I think there's data. And I think we can harness that data. I think we can say, oh, what did first wave feminism push and open and do? And what was the data? What did we learn? What did second wave feminism do? What did we learn? Where does intersectionality open new pathways for us? And what did we learn? Right. And to me, if you hold it that way, what we're learning all along is there are different ways for us to be leaders. There are different ways for us to be in community. And if you have a balance where all the different parts of a society are held equally in shaping those ways, all of a sudden new possibilities come into being. And my partner is someone who studies masculinity and masculinity outside of the idea of being something that only men have or can practice or can do.
Right.
And I think about this all the time that I'm like, we're in up on the precipice of gender opening and breaking wide and really starting to understand it in such a different way. And to me, feminism is a core part of how that happened for me. Is that I understood that I was like, oh, what I was given and told were the roles of gender are false. And if those are false, then I can start to shape for myself what it means to be in this world and be a human being taking responsibility for the conditions. And all the people in this book are folks who I see that way.
It's all part of sort of unraveling hierarchy in a sense, right? And my favorite phrase, you know, there are so many labels, but my favorite is really the umbrella of gender expansive.
Exactly. You know, so much of what's happening anytime we're holding a room is that we are trying to help people move past the constructs that we have been given in this period of history. And 100 years ago, they had different constructs, some of which are still holding on for dear life, some of which have shifted, right? But right now we have these constructs. We have white supremacy. We know white people are not supreme, right? To anyone, it's just, right? But there's the construct. We have patriarchy. We know men are not supreme. So we have the constructs of gender. We have these constructs of even what work and life are, right? There's all these boxes. And when you're facilitating, you're trying to help people move beyond those boxes into a sense of us, into a sense of the we, into a sense of like, what are the gifts I have to give? And what do I need from this group? And then how can this group shape what the community needs? And that deconstructing, right, is where it gets really exciting and really interesting. If you're with facilitation that is curious about, you know, who is in this room and what is possible, and we can give ourselves permission to be outside of those constructs. Every space, and I think Sage Crump speaks about this really beautifully in the book in her essay on culture, every space is a place where we get to practice the cultures that we want to create in the world. So it's not just, oh, we're here for a meeting. It's like, oh, we're here to practice the future, right?
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. So you talk specifically about ways that you're instinctively gifted at doing this work, But you've made a kind of user manual here, right, that offers ways for any of us to learn how to do this and facilitation at that sort of simple definition to make things easier. But what led you to do this work?
You know, I do think it was in my nature. Like I was drawn to justice work very early on. Like it was mm-hmm. something that shaped. And I think partially it was because I was raised in a household where at a certain age, I became aware that my parents were in active rebellion. My parents were in interracial relationship. They'd fallen in love in the South. And there were places that we would go where we weren't welcome and where either one of my parents wouldn't be welcome. And we would respond, you know, as a family, there would be this sort of moment of like, we are walking out of this place that is treating my father as a lesser human being because he's a Black man. And this, so those things imprint on you. And you start to recognize that the world is unjust, then politicization was so helpful for me. So I will say part of how I came to do the work was realizing there are things about the world that needed to change and that I felt responsible for those things changing. And then the actual work of facilitation, I mean, it really was like, this is what kept coming up and it was a way for me to learn. And I talk about that because I feel like it's so important to say, for the first 5 to 10 years that you're doing anything in movement, really you're a student and you should be a student. You should be learning. Right. And I think maybe some of that has gotten lost in translation with the way social media and the internet move now is that people are like, I'm in and now I need to know everything and I need to be leading. And you know, it's like, wait, you know, we should always, I think, always be learning all the way to the very end. But I think especially those beginning periods, it's like we need to be in spaces where it's okay to make mistakes. And it's okay to put our foot in our mouths and it's okay to, you know, say like, I didn't know that right now I'm learning that. So when I look back at baby Adrian coming into movement, I didn't know about transgender identity. I was still internalized homophobia. It was like, you know, running my life and I hadn't fully come out yet. I didn't really understand the power and beauty of Blackness. I knew that like I had Black power and Black pride, but I didn't fully have that in-depth like gratitude for the gift of my Blackness. There's just so many pieces of it that I'm like, oh, that all came through politicization. I didn't understand how the economy worked. I didn't understand that most movement is actually saying yeah to socialism, even if they don't want to put that language on it. Like I didn't understand those things. And it took years and I continuously keep learning, which is how I know I'm still alive. And one of my mentors, Grace Lee Boggs, lived to be 100 years and 100 days old. And one of the things that I learned from her is that you can stay curious all the way to the end, right? Mm-hmm. You can really keep learning. So for me, facilitation was a way for me to be in and learning where I was like, I can offer the synthesis of what y'all said, but I didn't know the things you said. Like I'm learning the things. I learned about reproductive justice. I learned about environmental justice. I learned about racial justice, all by being able to sit and hold and listen and through actual curiosity. Right? I was like, I actually want to know how y'all think we're going to get free. How are we going to get out of that situation? I want to hear what you have to say. And letting my own curiosity also guide what was happening in the room. My own moments of, aha, I get it, would also be part of the synthesis that could happen in the room. And Makani talks about this, Makani Thimba, about how when we are holding the room, it's not like we are blank slates or empty buckets. Or, you know, it's not like we're just supposed to be there as an empty chessboard that everyone's moving around upon. It's like we're also humans and we're also involved. And there are moments where we also need to intervene. And that's how I knew that my politicization had taken root, because there would be moments where I was like, wait, the thing that's happening now is not aligned with where we're trying to go. And I can feel that. And, you know, here's an offering. And now I think I'm in a new phase. I'm learning what this next phase is. It's a little harder to do facilitation now because of the visibility that I have as a writer, right? You can't really be a part of the container in the same way, but I'm learning like, well, what is it that I can teach? And this was the offering. This was the first big offering, was just like, I can tell you everything I know about how to hold change, you know. Mm-hmm. So far, the feedback is people are finding it useful. So that is good news to me.
It's such a gift in so many ways. And you've got this way that you introduce the book, where you invite people to walk through the book in different ways, right?
Yeah.
Which I really love. You offer us, there's these different parts. There's a section of assessments, which now that you're talking about it, data. And the writings on Black feminist wisdom as it's being lived, not just theory. And then the section on facilitation and mediation. So it's so interesting. Why did you, do you invite the reader to walk through in any way?
Yeah, well, you know, initially I thought it was going to be a choose your own adventure book. And I had this whole plan where you're going to start from the middle of the book and then you could choose your own adventure to work your way to the edges. And then as we were heading into the design phase, I was like, okay, that's not going to work in terms of helping people. it's not for me.
In two dimensions,
So I was like, I think it'll kind of convolute the thing that we want people to be able to do, which is easily access the data. But I still wanted to give people that option. And because I wrote it to be consumed in a nonlinear way, I wanted to remind people that that's always possible. I especially wanted to give people the option of going and reading the Black Feminist Wisdom first. Like it could offer a beautiful grounding, especially if you feel like, I'm pretty familiar with emergent strategy. I don't need the refresher. I can skip to that. Or if you're like, I'm coming in and I really don't have a clue about what I most need, then it's like, go to the assessments. And the assessments, my friend Zuri put those together and they're really skillfully done and they're easy to do. So you can just kind of get some self-assessment on like, where is it that I might need the most skill development? And then you can just go straight there, right? If you're great at adaptation, then that might not be where you need to start. You might want to go start with nonlinearity, right? Which is for some people the most challenging aspect of emergence.
Right.
And I wanted people to be able to move through the elements in ways that made sense to them. To me, a successful book like this would be one that could like live in a bathroom and people could pick it up while they're in the bathroom and spend like 5 minutes and come away like, I just got something that was like, this is useful. So my dream book is always like the bathroom book or the book that people are like, I can get something no matter how much time I have to put into it. I was told early in my life, people don't read books. And yet clearly my gift is writing books. Like I'm like, I like writing books. That's the way I think. And that's the way I operate. So I'm always trying to balance like writing books that even people who don't necessarily have time for a whole book can still access and get what they needed from it.
And also, we're in this short attention span world right now.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, you're inviting folks to kind of also undo the way we've been educated, right? Which is to be linear and to follow the rules and follow the chapter headings.
Yeah. So, and like the reality is, in a space that you're facilitating, the thing that's happening, even if you have a very straightforward agenda, the thing that's happening in the space is not linear. Like, emotions are going to come up when they come up and strategy is going to become clear when it becomes clear and relationships are going to form and the relationships forming will help everything else move, right? So the book is like that too. Also, there's people who are going to read this book and be like, I love Prentice, so I'm going to go read Prentice first and then I'll go do something else. And it's like relationship does that, right? People have a relationship with some of these writers, like you said. For some people, these are their favorite writers. So I'm like, yeah, go there first. No problem. You'll still get to everything you need to get to in the book.
Adrienne Marie Brown for joining us to talk about Holding Change. Definitely, we'll have all these links on our website.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate y'all having me on.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and via the Stitcher app. And tune in for more from Feminist Magazine. Thanks for listening.
At this time of year, we all think about the things we're thankful for. If you're thankful for the old family vehicle, you can let it help one more time by donating it to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program. The proceeds will help KPFK continue the independent programming you depend on throughout the year. The vehicle donation number is 877-KPFK-AUTO. Our representative will take care of everything. That number again is 877-KPFK-AUTO or donate online at kpfk.org.
ICE is escalating deportation operations around the Los Angeles area. But if you are stopped by ICE officers, you have constitutional rights, regardless of your immigration status. If you or someone you know has been detained or wants to report ICE, more information is available at CIRLA at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at CHIRLA.